Carlin Romano has been in the book business a long time. He's been the literary critic of the Philadelphia Inquirer and critic at large of the Chronicle of Higher Education. His criticism has appeared in The Nation, The New Yorker, The Village Voice, Harper's, The American Scholar, Salon, and The Times Literary Supplement. He was president of the National Book Critics Circle and a Pulitzer Prize finalist. Now in his new book, America, the Philosophical, Romano delivers a bold and insightful book that rejects the myth that we live in an unphilosophical society. He counters the claims of some scholars and argues that America in the 21st century is in an unprecedented marketplace of truth and debate that surpasses any other time or place in history. It's a great pleasure to welcome Carlin Romano to the roundtable. Thank you very much for being with us, sir. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me, Joe.
A delight. What brought you to this particular topic of looking at the philosophical state of the country?
Well, a number of things. You know, I've always been interested in philosophy itself since I was a teenager, and throughout my journalistic career, I've been teaching, you know, philosophy. And one thing that struck me was the contrast between all of these books and cliches about America as a dumbed-down, unphilosophical culture and what I was actually seeing in my jobs as the book critic and before that the literary editor at the Philadelphia Inquirer. I would get just slews of books, some by professional philosophers, but many by thinkers in other areas, many by journalists that were extremely thoughtful, philosophical in the way that I understand philosophy, with argument, with evidence, and so on. So this contrast just kept growing on me. Then in recent years, there's been a flood of books that really kind of stick it to America. You know, I mentioned in my introduction a book called Idiot America, for instance. And I just thought, this is crazy. You know, the cliches have it wrong. So that was one of the really powerful types of impetus for me in doing this.
One of the fascinating things about the book and the subject itself is just that word philosophy, because some of us do not hang on to that willingly. It is sometimes an onerous term. I don't know exactly how it got that way.
Yeah, it's a funny term because it still carries a lot of prestige in various contexts. You know, in America, we do have this notion of the philosopher in a negative way at times as absent-minded. Somebody needs to walk him across the street, tell him whether the light's green or red. On the other hand, it's considered a prestigious thing when it's used seriously for a thinker. So we've always been torn between those two things. You know, one of the arguments that I make in the book is that a kind of rarefied notion of philosophy that is often associated with very precise, minute, Socratic questioning is really not the only way of looking at philosophy, and it wasn't the only way in ancient Greece either. So I kind of vaunt a forgotten figure named Isocrates, just like Socrates with an I in front, he was a real person, who had a much broader view of philosophy as kind of deliberative process in society, where people argue, they don't just accept authority, they present evidence, they sustain their attention. And I think if we think of that as a model of philosophy, we're a lot closer to what takes place in this amazing country.
And as you write, that group can include scientists and psychologists and journalists and talk show hosts and literary critics.
That's right. Yeah, I mean, I cover all of them in the book. I try to make it clear at the beginning that even though this is a large book, you know, 672 pages, it's written in, I hope, a sprightly journalistic style, and it's not meant to be comprehensive. It's meant to be selective and representative. So, you know, I give a handful of each of those sorts of thinkers, you know, in broadcasting, you know, Bill Moyers in literary theory, someone like Edward Said, to just make the point that people have been philosophizing in this country without being officially professors of philosophy.
You talked about Idiot America a moment ago, but that idea that America is anti-intellectual, how do you believe that came about? How far does that date back, do you think?
Well, it dates back really to colonial, you know, times, in that for a very long period, we were subservient to England. We were the new kid on the block, and so Americans themselves often looked to Europe, in particular, you know, for their models of intellectual life. the big transition in our history comes with Emerson. I talk about that in the book because I have a long historical section at the beginning. Emerson was the person who really said to America, stand on your own 2 feet. You're pretty interesting yourself. Think for yourself. In a funny way, the Frenchman Tocqueville, who I quote early on in the book as saying Americans pay no attention to philosophy, they pay the least attention of anybody in the world, he kind of confirmed that by saying that Americans only pay attention to their own understanding. So my view is that, well, Americans actually, especially now, do pay attention to intellectual life, to other countries and so on, but they also pay attention to their own understanding. We have what I call a rude independence of mind, and that's part of the fuel, as far as I'm concerned, to this philosophical culture I see here.
And that philosophical culture that we have in this country, you argue, holds up very well if you compare it even to the philosophers of ancient Greece.
Yeah, I think especially so. I've had that question in a lot of the bookstore readings I've given. What about ancient Greece? Are you crazy? You know, have you been around since the beginning of the world that this is the greatest philosophical culture? And I say, well, you know, if you actually think about ancient Greece and who was there, the lack of diversity, you know, we're really talking about ancient Athens with a bunch of Athenian citizens and slaves, not a tremendous amount of diversity compared to what we have in the United States. It doesn't begin to look so good. You have a lot of similar thinking going on, a lot of shared values and beliefs. By contrast, in the United States today, we have people arguing for just about every belief system that has ever existed in the world. And part of that is because we have these communities. We have Chinese philosophers. We have Hmong philosophers. We have Latin American philosophers. We have African American philosophers. You tie that together with the unbelievable freedom of expression we have, which is greater than any country has ever had. I'm not saying it's perfect. It's not. But, when people want to make an argument in this country, they can generally do so without being shot in the head. You put that all together, and ancient Greece doesn't look so hot.
But when you put it all together, you also now have a very divided nation.
Well, that's true. But one way in which I look at America as a philosophical society is not to take the view that every individual has to make every argument, himself or herself. In other words, the warp and woof of argument that we do see in the culture, with the right-wingers making their arguments and the left-wingers making their arguments and people in the middle trying to sift among it. If you look at the big picture, we are seeing philosophy taking place. Now, when people ask me, well, who do you consider a philosopher? I don't consider somebody who is a complete ideologue, who is not open to evidence, closed-minded, doesn't sustain attention, has robotic talking points to make. I don't consider such a person a philosopher, any more than I consider a delusional person on the street who can't pull two sentences together articulately a philosopher. So I'm not saying every single person in the country is a philosopher, but if you look at the activity taking place in the country, arguments made, rejected, sustained, then I think my thesis holds.
I'm not going to take away from your thesis, but I'm just curious as to what you think of. People can look at the philosophical in a very broad term, and I think of the Peter Sellers character in the film being there. You look at someone you mentioned of taking someone off the street, of a person who has very simple statements are read very deeply and are brought to an ultimate level. That can happen as well, can't it?
Yes, it can, and I try to give a sense in the book, in an entertaining way, of the different ways that philosophy can be done. I mean, some people, for instance, have attacked me already in reviews for including what I call in the book the casual wise men. I include someone like Hugh Hefner. I include also someone like Robert Fulghum, you know, everything you needed to know you learned in kindergarten.
Right.
People who are operating, obviously, in one case in a business system, also in another case in a kind of simplistic, it seems, system of homilies. But it turns out, you know, Fulghum was actually very well philosophically educated. Hefner takes very seriously the civil libertarian stuff he's done over the years and his liberationist view of sexuality and so on. So, you know, we have philosophers who operate through aphorisms and maxims. We have philosophers, the more conventional sort, who write massive tomes that often go unread. What I'm saying is philosophy is not a scientifically precise concept. But neither is it a bowl of jelly. You can, roughly speaking, say that philosophy requires clarity, it requires argument, requires evidence, requires sustained attention. But you get beyond that, reasonable people can disagree. So, I'm arguing that by criteria like that, we are an amazingly philosophical culture.
Carlin Romano is the author of the new book, America the Philosophical. It is published by Knopf. And it seems in the book you write about religion and that the gap between those who believe and those who don't, the skeptics. Does that really go to prove your theory of how we can have this debate, or does it show that we really haven't come very far in the sense that we're still debating something that happened thousands of years ago?
Well, I kind of addressed this in my introduction, and then I guess in the way I formed the book. I'm different from Hitchens, my old acquaintance, in that I don't think, that believers should be burned at the stake or, taken off to institutions and so on. I think because of the logical peculiarities of a lot of religious terms and language, you can't disprove religious belief. And there are a lot of good religious people and good thinkers among religious people. I see it as a strength of our culture that we have this continuing debate that goes on between believers and non-believers. I'm not in favor of imposition of religious autocracy, but I guess the point at which I would draw a line, maybe not a bright line, is that to the extent to which a religious thinker is bound to authority, to scripture, and is not open to other sorts of evidence, I tend not to think of that person as a philosopher. But there are many people who have been otherwise. I'll give you two examples, the Dalai Lama and Sir John Templeton, who founded the Templeton Foundation, which tries to bring scientists and religious thinkers together. Both of those people were spiritual in various ways. The Dalai Lama, of course, still is. But they're very open to science. They think there can be some kind of reconciliation. So I tend to appreciate that and think of it as part of a philosophical culture.
When you look at that philosopher culture and where we are right now, and this book certainly gives us a lot of history, but also looks at where we are at the moment. The epilogue is Obama, philosopher in chief. Explain that a little bit of why you feel that way.
Sure, and I want to say I just noticed today in Slate magazine that the Obama campaign is now referring officially to Romney as the outsourcer in chief. So I'm hoping there'll be some nice philosophical debate there, philosopher in chief versus outsourcer in chief. But my epilogue is meant to be serious about Obama as in the line of philosophical presidents we've had. And we've had some good ones. We've had Jefferson, Madison, Lincoln, and so on. I say he's the most philosophical since Woodrow Wilson. Essentially, I'm arguing two things. One, I'm writing a little bit on an excellent book called Reading Obama by James Kloppenberg, a great intellectual historian at Harvard, who really went back and looked at Obama's education, his reading of Reinhold Niebuhr, other important thinkers, to show that Obama has a powerful intellectual spine. He's been a heavy reader of serious work over time. The second thing I do is I look at a number of his speeches, including one that didn't get the attention it deserved, his Nobel Prize speech. In that speech, he makes a really pithy, incisive presentation about why you need to use force sometimes in the service of right. Not everybody may agree with that, but I think if you look at his various speeches, the Tucson speech after the shooting of the Congresswoman, the Nobel Prize speech, you see a genuinely philosophical mind at work. And he marks up his drafts, and he participates very strongly as a writer. So I've rejected the idea in some, bookstore talks that, but he doesn't do his own stuff. I think he does.
You take issue with Noam Chomsky in the book.
Yes, that's true. Chomsky, of course, is a fascinating character. I mean, enormously influential in linguistics, and in my view, terribly unfair-minded in politics. I try to give evidence of that in the book. It seems to me that he's always attributing the worst of motives to people in the American government. It seems to me he's not always getting his facts right. But, you know, he's a spirited part of America the Philosophical. He's kind of outside the 40-yard line and the 40-yard line. He doesn't get much airtime on American TV and radio. I'm not in favor of that. I'd put him on. But again, I think in the book I'm neither right nor left. I attack people on both sides at times, and I appreciate people on both sides.
Do you come to this line of thought, of thinking about philosophical thought, from being a literary critic, of listening and reading the words that have come forth over several decades?
Yeah, well, I think that has had a lot to do with it. The fact that I am a book person, going back to my early teen years, bicycling off to used bookstores and coming back with more books than my father thought made sense. I have always, despite a deep interest in philosophy, been intrigued by almost everything. And the more books I got, the more I opened up to different countries and belief systems and so on. So even though I'm now a professor of philosophy, you know, having left the newspaper some years ago, I still have, I guess, a more capacious view of what philosophy is. I see it in philosophical novels. I see it in books by brilliant journalists or intellectuals in other fields. So, you know, in the book, when I present other sorts of thinkers rather than official philosophy professors, someone like a B.F. Skinner, a psychologist, I'm trying to say, how can you think this person isn't a philosopher? He's doing everything a philosopher does.
You also talk about your fellow literary critics like Kenneth Burke and Harold Bloom and Edward Said, as you mentioned earlier.
Yeah, well, I think they're part of this, you know, ball game. You know, I try to mix it up too. I wanted, as a literary work, I wanted America the Philosophical to somehow give a sense of the rambling and unstructured nature of American thought. I didn't want it to have an old-fashioned scientific organization. So a few reviewers have sort of felt that it's chaotic, but I try to explain my procedure very much at the beginning. And with the literary folk, sometimes with Kenneth Burke, who I interviewed at length, I do a more dramatic literary scenario of him late in life talking about his career. At other times, with someone like Harold Bloom and Edward Said, I mix interviewing with my own critical assessment of the work. So I'm trying to sort of keep the reader on his or her feet, not just having one style throughout.
Do you think that the average American, of having these discussions and being America the Philosophical, when you look at how we are portrayed, when you look at how we are portrayed in the media, how we about our popular culture, would seem to go against much of that?
Well, sure, and that's one reason I wrote this book. I mean, I believe in jaunty intellectual boldness when you think something is right. So even the title of the book, which was my title, I very much wanted the publisher to use that title. I wanted it to have tone. You know, mm-hmm. Americans hear that America the Beautiful behind it. It strikes them as a little oxymoronic. America the Philosophical? That's, you know, I never heard of that. So that I think is one of the things you do as a writer to try to get people, you know, interested. But I'm very much against the grain here of American intellectual history, and I think common media thought. And the media thought has just gone more and more in that direction, like we're getting dumber and dumber, which I don't think is true.
So how do we support that material that is so successful in television, in books, in movies? How do we then say, okay, we are America the Philosophical, but this is what is making the money?
Well, I would say, you know, what people in media should do is to be unafraid of doing smart, intelligent, philosophical things with your airtime or your print real estate. You know, not to toss you a cheap compliment, but here we are, you know, talking about a book about philosophy
right.
on the radio. That's a good thing, and I've been heartened to see the number of, you know, of radio shows that have expressed interest, because I think more so than TV, radio still pays attention to serious books and people who want to think. But when I was at the newspaper, the Philadelphia Inquirer, for 25 years, I had a lot of friction with my bosses because I ran books that were smart and that were by scholars, and I passed up ephemeral books and junky books, you know, that were going to have a two-week lifespan. I think when you're in the media, you have to stand up for stuff that is important and good, and when you do that, I think audiences appreciate it.
The name of the book is America the Philosophical. It is published by Knopf. Carlin Romano, I thank you so much for being with us, and I wish you all the luck in the world in this project.
Thank you, Joe. Real pleasure.
A great pleasure. Thank you. Again, the name of the book, America the Philosophical. It's published by Knopf. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.